You started at the Times in 1988 as the national computer writer, and you covered the RTM virus.
Yes, it was called the Morris worm. In November of 1988, a Cornell University graduate student whose name was Robert Tappan Morris launched this program into the internet, which was then composed of about 60,000 computers. And he meant to simply have a program that would travel around the then sort of brand new network and basically do nothing, just be there. It was clever. But he made one mistake, and it was a programming error, and it was actually a design error. He didn't understand how quickly things moved between the different computers. And he was being very clever. He thought he was being very clever. He basically wanted to fool computers in a particular way. And at a certain point, he had to figure out how often, even when he was already on a computer, he should go anyway and send himself again. And he picked the number 1 and 7. And 1 and 7 turned out to be just a terrible mistake. And immediately, there were tens of thousands of instances of his program running on virtually every host computer in the internet, and they all bogged down and stopped. He almost took the entire network down.
Why did he want to replicate himself more than once in all of these?
He would design the worm not to go to the same computer more than once. And so he thought, well, if somebody wanted to fool me, they would simply say, I'm already here, and then I wouldn't go. And so he decided that 1 in every 7 times he would go anyway. And he thought that that was a clever way around that defense. And it turned out to be a catastrophic programming mistake. And he brought the network to its knees.
Are you the person who broke the story of his identity?
I am. That's an interesting story. You know, it was just a really quite an amazing story. The Washington Post had 7 bylines on their first day story. And on the second day, it was sort of toward deadline, and I had already had this sort of odd call from somebody in Boston who said that he knew who the person who wrote the program was. He called him Mr. X, and we had a couple of phone conversations. And he wanted to know what kind of trouble he was in, and I said, I don't know, and we went back and forth. And on his third call to me, he made a mistake, and instead of referring to this person as Mr. X, he called him RTM. And I knew enough about the Unix operating system to realize that that was probably a Unix login. I called another person who I knew who was a computer networking expert, and he used a software tool, to look around, and we pretty quickly found this name at Cornell University, Robert Tappan Morris, but I didn't really know what to do with it. So when this person called me back from the National Security Agency, I said, I think I know who did it. And he said, who is it? And I said, well, wait a minute, I'm not going to tell you because you're the computer police. And we went back and forth for a couple minutes, and I was just on my deadline. I mean, I really had just 10, 15 minutes to file. And finally, it got so weird because everything I said, this guy knew more about it than I did. And I thought, how could the NSA know more about this than I know about it? And finally, I said, I think the person who did it was Robert Tappan Morris. And he said, you're right, and which was great because I had a government source confirming what I had heard. And I was about to get off. I was very panicked. And at the end of the call, I said, well, that's kind of weird. You have the same name as that person. And he said, no, it's not weird. It's my son. So Robert Morris Sr. was the chief scientist of the National Security Agency. So it made it an even more powerful story.
Wow. And obviously, as you note, Robert Tappan Morris Jr., I won't say he got a slap on the wrist, but he went on to do pretty well.
He went on to do a lot of good stuff. I mean, he became a professor at MIT, and he got his PhD at Harvard, and he started a successful internet company. So he's an example of a computer hacker who went straight.
What's the difference between white hat hackers and black hat hackers?
So inside the computer security community, there is a general understanding that you can really never prove that computers are secure unless you test them. You really have to try to break into them and figure out sort of what the weak spots are from the mindset of an attacker. And that's what a white hat hacker does.
And the black hats are the ones who are doing it for real.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, the term hacker is this really ambiguous term. I mean, it was created during the 1950s and 1960s to identify a group of sort of passionate computer designers, software and hardware designers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And then the word sort of morphed in the 1980s. I don't know if you remember the movie War Games, but mm-hmm. War Games forever sort of transformed the term from from one meaning into this sort of adolescent teenager who comes close to starting a nuclear war with a modem and a personal computer.
What'd you think of that movie?
One of my favorites.
You've written about Conficker. Where did this come from? What is it?
So Conficker is a program that has some aspects of a worm. That means that it can move from computer to computer under its own power, and it has some aspects of a virus. That means that it can attach itself to a document and be hand-carried by a USB key from computer to computer. And it has a little bit of intelligence. It guesses passwords when it's on a computer. It looks around the network and can move that way as well by having a small library of passwords that it tests. And what it does is it tries to install itself on as many computers as it can. It's been very successful. It's at last count that I saw, it was on over 12 million machines around the world, mostly not in the United States, but in many, many machines. And then it's a multi-stage program that makes up in its entirety a distributed application called a botnet. And a botnet is essentially basically taking the open internet and turning it into a supercomputer. So you have a computer that's composed of 12 million individual parts that you can program to do anything you want. Now, the interesting sort of puzzle about Conficker is that somebody distributed it, and in theory, at some point, they will send the programming instructions to all the sort of computers that have been turned into zombies, that have been taken over by Conficker, and they can do whatever they want. Anything that the individual computers can do on the network, the Conficker author can force these machines to do. And so what might that be? They could cause them to distribute more malware. They could cause them to send spam. They could cause them to basically send fire hoses of data at different companies or networks on the internet and shut them down. And no one knows what's planned because the second stage hasn't been launched yet.
So if the computer is the human body, this is some sort of virus that is sitting there waiting to flare up. People know it exists. They even know roughly how many machines it's on, but they don't know where it comes from, and they don't know what will happen if it becomes activated. Why don't they just get rid of it?
Well, it's not that easy if you're talking about 12 million computers that are in people's homes and, you know, stuffed away in nooks and crannies all over the world, that's quite a cleanup job. In theory, you could take over Conficker's control mechanism and cause all the programs on all the different computers to commit suicide, but that would be breaking the law. And if you made a mistake in your programming, you might do tremendous damage. So, Microsoft and many other security companies distribute free tools that you can run on your computer, and they look for Conficker and they'll remove it, but that's one computer at a time, and it hasn't been cleaned up yet.
So it's sitting like an unexploded bomb. How long has it been there?
I think the first copies of Conficker were discovered in October. A couple of versions of the program have been released, and the second one was really effective at spreading widely in the internet.
Can you explain what bots are? I'm sure that there's someone listening out there
who has
one on their computer and doesn't know what it is.
The botnet goes and buries itself deeply into the operating system, and it's hidden there. You don't see it, but it talks to the internet, and it gets its instructions from some command and control computer that may be in Russia or China. Most of the spam in the world today is distributed by botnets. Consider the fact that the bad guys have free supercomputers. That's where we're at today. And there's not just one botnet out there, but there are hundreds and hundreds of botnets. And they do everything from stealing passwords and login information, stealing bank account information, stealing credit card information, to sending out scareware, the kinds of things that'll pop up on your machine and say your computer is infected. Would you like to spend $29.95 and buy this program to fix your computer from the Ukraine? to, you know, running these things that are called DDoS attacks, distributed denial of service attacks, where the computers are basically harnessed together to project a fire hose of data packets at a target.
How integrated are our infrastructure computers? Can a virus really turn off the lights?
The answer is yes and no. So that's the scenario that's in every science fiction and thriller movie you've ever seen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there's not a lot of real-world examples of things like this happening. There was a test at the Idaho National Power Laboratory that showed that a power generator that was connected to the internet could be attacked remotely. There was also a very well-publicized incident that happened at the Davis-Besse nuclear power plant in 2003, about 5 years ago, in which a piece of malware, a virus or a worm, got into the computers that controlled the operation of the nuclear power plant. The safety system of the nuclear power plant. Luckily, at the time, the power plant was offline. But that network was down for most of a day, and there's been a lot of speculation about what might have happened if the power plant had been online.
Your article really does present a pretty scary view of the security of the internet in the future and the potential impact of breaches on daily life.
Yeah, I've been reporting about computer security issues related to computers and computer networks for about 30 years, and I think that just about all of the security people that I talk to, the white hats, believe that the good guys are losing the war. Many engineers and technical people believe that the internet is fundamentally flawed and it needs to be fixed, and there are a number of efforts underway to do that. There are real security threats on the internet. Millions and millions of dollars are being stolen from consumers. There are military threats. There are threats to our national security. The Bush administration in 2008 in January issued a classified national strategy document that was in response to things that have been happening to the military and the governmental networks that has been widely reported. Those attacks are real. No one's clear on where they're coming from, but it's indisputable the attacks are happening.
You said in your article that many security researchers view the nearly two decades of efforts to patch the existing network as a Maginot Line approach to defense, which is the reference to France's series of fortifications that proved ineffective during World War II. Can you sort of enlarge on that a little?
What computer security people like to say is, hard shell, soft, chewy center. Which means that once you breach the password login protection on personal computers, you are in control of the machine. You can do whatever you like. And there are many people who feel that we need more authentication, more control at the very deep sort of system level to protect users in a way from themselves.
Can you explain, again, it was in your piece, that what happened last November when the U.S. military command in charge of both Iraq and Afghanistan found that their computers had been breached?
Well, so one of the remarkably simple ways to get access to a computer, even if it's perhaps in a classified facility, is to persuade someone to carry the malware into the machine. In a Trojan horse kind of approach. And a really effective way of doing that is to put the bad software, the malware, on a thumb drive or a USB key and then persuade someone to plug that into the computer that you're attacking. And there are lots of different ways of doing that. One simple way is simply to sprinkle them in a parking lot. The first thing people do is they pick them up and plug them into the computer to see what's on the thumb drive, and in the process they infect their computers.
You're not telling me that military officials picked up infected thumb drives and thought, ooh, a free thumb drive, let's stick it in our highly classified computer.
Well, the actual details around that incident that happened in – or set of incidents that happened in November haven't become public, but one of the things that is public is that the U.S. military banned the use of thumb drives on all of their machines. So you can sort of assume that something bad happened.
You know, one thing that others have said, spam, viruses, hackers, they don't really want to tear the system down. They just want to steal enough credit cards or make enough money selling Viagra that they don't ruin the whole system because it's the goose that lays the golden eggs. But you seem to suggest that it's a matter of time before someone takes down the whole system. Isn't that against the nature of a virus that feeds off of its host?
You know, no one has tried to destroy the internet yet. I think, you know, on a systemic level, I think we've been very lucky. But if you look at something like Conficker sitting on 12 million machines, I think if someone has really bad intent, they could do a lot of damage. I don't know that they could take the net down permanently. And I don't subscribe completely to the biological analogy. I think there are a lot of bad people out there who would love to see the internet rendered ineffective. I don't think that that's a big stretch to say that those people are probably out there in the world. Give them a tool like Conficker and they might be able to do something really terrible.
Tell me about the Stanford Clean Slate Project. I still have a little bit of trouble understanding it. Are they really talking about a parallel internet?
So this community is funded by the National Science Foundation, who about 5 years ago set up a next-generation internet project called Genie. And the Clean Slate Project at Stanford is a joint industry National Science Foundation-funded effort to begin developing advanced networking technologies both for scientific and consumer applications. And what was interesting about the Clean Slate Project to me, it was a way of slipping new technologies underneath the existing internet to allow you to do new things while you carry the old traffic. And that probably is the only way we'll be able to evolve the network. And they don't have – the other thing that's clear about Clean Slate is they don't believe they have the future. What they wanted to do is create a platform on which researchers could experiment with new technologies while they carried the existing technology.
So how would that work?
Well, you would simply add special hardware and software to existing routers so that it could carry parallel protocols to the existing internet protocols.
Just to people who are testing this thing or out into the world?
Experimenters and researchers. And so this is already running at Stanford on a number of computers. And by the end of the summer, it will be running on 8 campuses around the country. And a researcher who has a new idea for security or for some advanced networking application can run their protocols that may be totally different than the internet protocols, which are called TCP/IP, and not get in the way, and yet perhaps develop something that's more secure, more robust, supports some cool new application. One of the real weaknesses of the internet architecture is for mobility. And so now we're all carrying these internet-connected computers around with us. They're called cell phones or smartphones or iPhones or RIMs or BlackBerries or what have you. And the current network protocols do a terrible job, an inefficient job of supporting that kind of use. And so there are a lot of people who want to develop more efficient ways of carrying that information, mobile information. It's a good application for this kind of a system.
It still doesn't sound to me like a parallel net. It just sounds like some researchers in Stanford testing out some new fixes and patches.
No, it is it basically, if you wanted to create something that was totally different than TCP/IP, a whole different way of networking, you could put that up on these computers and it could run at the same time that the internet was running on it in parallel. So it's very much a parallel platform. I mean, think of it as just a test bed for trying new ideas, which also supports the old ideas.
So you're not replacing anything. You're superimposing something on it.
Let's say you invented something that was better and everybody loved it and they began using it. It's a great way to sort of move the world from the old world to the new world.
Isn't the problem the fact that people just don't want to fix their computers at the user end? I mean, we've heard that even some Microsoft IT engineers don't even want to be bothered putting their own fixes on their own computers.
I think that's like saying, isn't the person who drove the Chevy that had that, you know, that gas tank that blew up. Isn't it their, you know, their fault? I think that's a classic case of blaming the victim. The reality is that perhaps 1% of the computer users in the world will ever be, you know, should we use the word clueful enough to sort of understand what's going on in their machines? I think this is a problem of the people who produce the technology, not the people who use it. And I don't think that the problem will ever be solved by convincing people to patch their computers. Mm-hmm. It just won't happen.
You wrote that for all these efforts to increase security, including this effort that's been launched at Stanford, the real limits to computer security may lie in human nature.
There are a couple things that I was thinking about. One is the tendency of people to be gullible. So many of the attacks now, sort of launched by bad people, by criminals over the internet, exploit people's the ability to fool people. For example, there are many scams that are identified as you know, the Nigerian 419 scams that involve email from people who claim to be widows of very wealthy people who are looking for ways to transfer $23 million out of the country. And if you'll just give them your bank account number, they'll put it in your bank. You know, people still fall for that.
So by human nature, you mean people are stupid.
Well, I don't know if they're stupid. I actually think that the really terrible thing about what's happening is that the bad guys exploit in some ways what's best about human nature. Our tendency to trust people and to want to help. And that's really the equivalent of the tragedy of the commons is that that these people have destroyed the sort of the inherent sort of trust that human beings have for each other.
Well, here's the thing: is that what a lot of people say, the laissez-faire types, if you will, on this issue, and I really wonder what you think about this. A lot of people say, look, it is all those teenagers in their basements, all of those brilliant and anonymous innovators around the world that have made the internet so brilliant, so responsive, so quick to figure out what our needs are and to fill them. And it's also the place from where all the bad stuff springs. Isn't it possible that the cure will come from those anonymous little corners, countless corners all over the world, rather than from Stanford University?
Oh, I think you're precisely right. I mean, that was sort of part of my education about the internet. I mean, I began as an internet utopian. And then somewhere along the line, a friend of mine who is an internet security person and a networking guru, this is really early on, this is probably 1992 or 1993, and he was hired by AOL to build their mail gateway, the email gateway, between AOL and the open internet so you could send an email to anyone connected to the internet. So it was really at the beginning. And he spent a couple weeks in Reston, Virginia, or wherever their headquarters was. And he came back out to the West Coast and he was shaking his head and he said, you know, it's like a big city and people are getting mugged in the back alleys. And that was really a wake-up call for me that the network is simply a mirror for everything good and bad in the real world. It's not a refuge from everything that goes on in the physical world. It's simply a reflection.
So you are a utopian no more.
I'm battle weary.
John, thank you so much.
Yeah, talk to you soon.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.